Hello, 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 Power Kids, and welcome to another Power Kid podcast. Guys, every episode, it is my honor, joy, and privilege to bring you great conversations from all over the world with people making great things for kids, making toys, making games. I'm your host, Phil Albritton, and I have with me Evan Katz and Josh Roberts from Very Special Games. Let me introduce you to them. Evan and Josh started Very Special Games in 2019 in Memphis. From the first sticky note game concept, they launched their first game, Charty Party, with a successful Kickstarter. Since then, they have developed and launched a litany of popular party games, including Ransom Notes, Abduction, and Puns of Anarchy. Guys, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Phil. Thanks for having us.
Awesome to be here.
Absolute pleasure to have you guys. Always love to talk to game people. I think game people's minds just work a little bit differently. So it's awesome to connect and have these conversations with both of you. Take us back, though, maybe even before 2019, but tell us, how did you get involved in the game industry?
Well, do you want the short version or the long version? Because if Josh goes, I'll tell you the long version, and I'll probably tell you too short of a version.
Well, we've got plenty of time, so we'll let you both go. How about that?
All right, take it away, Josh.
Yeah, sure. So Evan and I worked at the same growth strategy and innovation consulting firm in Memphis, Tennessee. And one day I come into the office, and Evan's already there, which is very unusual to start. And he tells me about a conversation he had had the night before with a group of friends about whether or not there's a direct correlation between your age and how much you're willing to pay for something. And the example he used was a steak dinner. So like in your early 20s, you're kind of, you know, graduating college, maybe just finding your footing with your first job, and maybe a $20 steak dinner at Applebee's is kind of the upper limit of what you're willing to do there. But maybe in your 60s or 70s, you've had a successful career and you're on retirement. And you're looking to treat yourself a little bit, so maybe you'll spend $60 or $70 on your steak dinner at maybe a nice steakhouse in town. So that gives me a little bit of a chuckle, but I don't think Evan was satisfied with my mild chuckle. And he said, do you think we could turn that into a game?
always the question, right? Always the question with us guys.
Yeah, right. So then I got intrigued. I was like, yeah, I do think we could turn that into a game. And we kind of almost instantly started drawing up on sticky notes these sort of absurd x-axis graphs. So some of the favorites are like your fitness level. Age is obviously one that made the final cut, but there. I'd like to tell people that Charty Party is math adjacent. It's not math direct. So you might see something on a linear chart that doesn't actually make sense as a linear chart, but for the sake of the game and comedy, it's okay.
Well, and Phil, you got to know that at this time, Josh and I are both working at a small strategic business consulting firm, so. It doesn't really matter if listeners know what that is. It just matters that we looked at a lot of charts in our day-to-day work. And a lot of them very boring. So there was a lot of fodder around to be like, how could we relabel this chart to be way funnier than
this is a game built out of desperation, it sounds like. How do we turn this boring job into a fun game?
Yeah, for sure. No, that's a good point of emphasis. Thank you. Anyway, so to wrap this up, we drew up, maybe a dozen charts, and ended up playing an overly complicated and slow version of what ultimately became Charty Party with our interns that day. But what we learned is that it was fun and it was funny, and we had something there. So we kind of just started taking the next natural step. I think under the auspices of, we are consultants, it would be interesting to learn how product development works from the inside, and how Kickstarter works, and ultimately Facebook advertising, and just, kind of get under the hood with some of that stuff and become deeper experts. So if we had some direct-to-consumer companies we're working for with consultancy, we could speak with a little bit more credibility born of our personal experience with it. But then we put Charty Party on Kickstarter, and it outperformed our expectations, which initially were like, wouldn't it be cool if we had to print like 200 copies of this thing? and it'll just be a neat story to tell somewhere down the road. And then it turned out our first print run's like 10,000 copies.
Nice.
Because the Kickstarter did. Yeah, thank you. Because the Kickstarter did so well. And then that was sort of the spark that started the business. We just wrapped up our seventh Kickstarter campaign mid 2022. And we've got development on our next product that we hope to get up on Kickstarter sometime this week.
Very good. It's interesting that you are on your seventh Kickstarter. So you have found real success with launching games on Kickstarter and using that as a springboard for your ideas. How has your strategy on Kickstarter, and Evan, I'll kick this one to you. How does your strategy on Kickstarter changed from Kickstarter number one to Kickstarter number seven? What have you learned? How has Kickstarter changed? How is it different now?
That's a great question. I think the short answer is it really hasn't changed fundamentally. But of course, we've gotten better in some key ways. I think one thing that we very intentionally did when we launched our first Kickstarter was we said to ourselves, we have no idea what we're doing in pretty much every aspect of this business. And we were probably going to mess some stuff up along the way. And so in order to mitigate that, we were like, let's just copy the hell out of the way that a lot of other similar Kickstarters are set up, like even if we don't get why they're doing stuff. So everything right. from like price points to like how much stuff is on their page, how long are their videos? Like we didn't really know why people seemed to always have like a 1 to 2 minute video instead of like a 7 minute video. You know, looking back now, it's because no one wants to watch 7 minutes of content, but right. you know, we were like, we don't know what we don't know. Let's just like copy it as much as possible. The game itself can be, you know, the thing that is unique enough. And let's not reinvent the wheel and everything else. And that really, I think, saved us from ourselves in a lot of ways. Maybe even tried to simplify our campaigns further after that first one. On our first Kickstarter, we did some custom stuff. Like, you know, you could get a custom deck of cards if you were a backer at like $100 or $200 or something like that. You know, that was a very cool thing to do just as a add-on. But we found logistically it was really hard to deliver and hard to do well and like, you know, made it so we couldn't focus on getting people the majority of people, the game that they pledged on time and well. So that's yeah. really become our focus going forward.
Yeah. Keep it simple. Have you built an audience for your games at this point? You have those email lists of people that have backed your games in the past. Do they come back now for your new games? They're interested. Are you having a conversation with your audience on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a really nice thing about Kickstarter too, is like they will do that for you automatically. So if you are launching your second Kickstarter campaign, everyone who backed your first campaign is going to find out about it through Kickstarter. And, you know, if you can run one successful Kickstarter, you've got a very good chance of running a second or third successful one too for that very reason.
Yeah. And Kickstarter has become a go-to place for games. There are communities that just look on Kickstarter for new games that they can't find, you know, anywhere else. Why do you think that gamers have been magnetized to Kickstarter like that? Is this something that's just happened organically? Do you think it's something in the Kickstarter, you know, business model that pulls gamers in? What have you seen there?
I'll let Josh jump in on the community aspect, but just from a business standpoint, Kickstarter and just crowdfunding platforms in general, I think has been a huge part of like the, you know, independent company created gaming renaissance that we've been in for the last like, what, 10 years or something. You know, it used to be Hasbro and Mattel were putting out Monopoly and Connect Four. And if you wanted to break into the gaming industry, like you had to have the budget up front to do your first print run and to frankly take all the risk that this game was going to go anywhere. Crowdfunding kind of flips that on its head, and without going into too many details, you both get to see if there's demand for your game up front, which is mm-hmm. critical.
Right.
And you get all the money up front, which is, you know, for people like me and Josh, we didn't have venture funding or, you know, big pockets to draw from. But for that first game, you know, we raised $50,000, and that was enough to be able to do this print run and kind of launch the business, which was huge.
Yep. Well, and your backers get to feel like they're a part of building this as well. They get something that no one else potentially has, right? They get to say, we were there first when this company launched, when this game was launched. We got the first edition. A lot of Kickstarter first edition games are collector's items now. Josh, what about your audience? What kind of conversations are you having with them? Do they come to you now and say, hey, this would be neat if we did this, this separate rule set or this expansion of this game? Do they come to you with new game ideas? What kind of relationship is that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Kind of everything under the sun. So I think one of the things that's very interesting about the community on Kickstarter, you know, Evan intimated a little bit about how we're willing to really simplify our campaigns, which in a way means we have room to adjust the product once people have seen it on Kickstarter. So if we get really interesting pieces of feedback, like we can add something to the rules, we can stress test a game mechanic in order to change it. And we can really take some of the more actionable feedback and put it in the game. I think with our most recent campaign for Abduction, a good example of that is through a combination of playtesting and some user feedback from some of the community that we've built over the years. We didn't have a way to, without getting into too much detail, we didn't have a way to wipe the board and give players a hard reset. But that was something that came from the community. And you know, once we put it in front of people and stress tested and play tested whether or not it made sense to have a hard reset mechanism, it worked out really well. And, you know, that's not something that came from Evan and I's imagination. That was something that we got from user feedback and were able to put in the game before we went to mass production. So Kickstarter does give you an opportunity to put a concept in front of people and kind of get some input on what they think it should be and what the game they want to play looks like. And then you can kind of co-create it in a way that ends up making a really compelling product. If you don't mind, I'd love to add to Evan's answer a little bit why Kickstarter is kind of an effective platform for creators. And I started a little bit on us, but I actually want to talk about somebody else's game, if that's okay, because I adore it. And I think it's kind of a best case scenario example of what Kickstarter can be for game creators. So I think the headline here is if you're in game development pre-Kickstarter, like you have to get your game into mass retail for it to be a viable business. Like that's just the truth. There's no other option. And there's limited space. There's limited appetite for, you know, products that maybe aren't going to have a mass appeal to everybody who walks into a large retailer, for example. And that kind of just stifles creativity and mechanics and art design and story and all sorts of stuff, right? So I think it was during our Ransom Notes campaign. I spent a lot of time on Kickstarter, especially when we've got a campaign going. But there was one for a game called My Father's Work, which is like a generational engine builder sort of thing that's really cool. But what's really interesting about it is it has components where, you know, my my game production mind couldn't help but think, you know, these little glass tubes with actual corks in them must cost $1 each to put in this game.
Sure, right.
Must cost 75 cents each to put in this game. And just like a beautiful set of a lot of components, like this really sophisticated product. But their campaign was like, hey, listen, we're only going to do one print run on this thing. It costs too much to make. It's never going to get into Target or Barnes and Noble because we have to sell it for $150. But it's this avenue where, you know, if you have this great idea for this really complicated product that's really imaginative and really fun, like My Father's Work is, it, you know, at least to me, you can take a chance on something that's high concept and high creative and see if you can build an audience for it. And you can do a print run. And if I remember correctly, they did over $1 million. So, you know, a nice little year's worth of work or 2 years worth of work going into to make it something that you know, they know has kind of a finite trajectory and finite life cycle because it doesn't fit the mold of what needs to go into mass retail. But they get to flex the creative muscle and get a really cool product out into the world, even though it's limited in scope. And without something like Kickstarter, you just can't do that.
And there's a place for that kind of game, that kind of, you know, what we would consider, I guess, at mass retail to be overdeveloped, right? You say, oh, we can't sell it at Target. It's overdeveloped. It's got too much cost in it. But if you go direct to consumer and you get that consumer really charged and fired up about your game and about the components and about the details of it and how unique it is, then there is a place. And I think that's intensely valuable. I think it's something that we're missing since the end of Toys R Us, especially in the toy industry. We have to make a place for products that we want to produce. And there has to be that shelf space. And, you know, more and more, there's not. And it's great to hear that there's an outlet for that level of creativity and that level of complexity. And, you know, I'm looking at the game right now, the little glass vials with the corks in the top. That's amazing. That's amazing. What a great game to play. Which brings us to a conversation about what draws you to party games in particular. Is there a filter that you guys take your ideas through? It needs to have X number of components. It needs to just have this type of material. It needs to be FOB, you know, this price versus, you know, the rule set, or you're following trends and it needs to hit, you know, this particular trend. How do you think about new games?
Wow. There's a whole lot we can say there. oh boy. Well, you're probably going to get a real in-depth answer from both Josh and I. So, let's see.
Well, listen, it's something that I'm passionate about. It's something that my listeners are passionate about. So let it roll. This is the kind of stuff that we want to hear, that the in-depth experience from everybody that I talk to on the show. So no fear. Let it roll.
Sure. Well, you know, the original part of that question was, why have you been drawn to party games versus other stuff? And I guess I typically look at the industry of, it's the spectrum from the simplest, most inane party games to, you know, these incredibly complex, you know, kind of Gloomhaven or even farther than that type strategy games. And obviously the stuff that we've made so far, I hope we're not in the inane category of party games. We like to think our stuff still is very woody and can be very cerebral if you want it to. But at the end of the day, it's a party game. And they're meant to be something that you can learn quickly and play with a group of people who may range from total non-gamer to somebody who is a strategy person, kind of bring everyone together in that sense. But, you know, when we're thinking of game concepts, I think probably the most important filter that we need it to go through is the core activity fun to do on its own, even if it wasn't a game? And I think that's been kind of our guiding light. And it wasn't until recent years that we even like were able to articulate that to ourselves. But like, you know, Josh talked about Charty Party at the beginning of the call, and like Josh and I both just found funny charts to be very funny. You know, you find them all over the internet, whether it's a bar chart or even, you know, a funny Venn diagram or something. Mm-hmm. And that was just something that we thought was fun and hilarious before it was gamified. And, you know, same thing for puns. We could on a different call get into like the full on backstory of where that concept came from. But like making puns has always been one of, I would say, an extremely large portion of my sense of humor. And I think Josh's as well, in turning a, you know, a band into a dumb pun, is funny on its own. And you can probably find that thread in all of our games, which is to say the thing you're doing is funny, or is entertaining in and of itself. And then usually people just need kind of the illusion of a game around it in order to, like, you know, say to themselves, like, why am I sitting here doing this dumb thing with my friends? It's like, oh yeah, because I want to win. But like, it's not really about the winning. It's about you'd like doing this activity because it generates something funny. It generates something wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think I would just add to that, right, there were a couple of other questions in there. So Puns of Anarchy is a good example of a fun core activity. But it also needs to be accessible. You know, Puns of Anarchy was not the first pun-based party game by any stretch of the imagination, but part of our development process did include reading a lot of reviews for other pun games, just to, you know, kind of make sure that we're actually going down a path where we're creating something novel and interesting and at least a little bit new to the world. And one of the things we found in reading all those reviews was this common thread of people saying, you know, punning is a core tenet of my entire sense of humor, and this game is too hard to play. So accessibility has really become kind of that 1B guiding principle to the core activity being fun. Is like, is it fun and can people play it? And I think, you know, Puns of Anarchy is a great example of the last part of the question is how much does, you know, cost of goods and product manufacturing kind of, and you worded it differently, but I think the idea is still there, drive how we create games. And you know, at first with Puns of Anarchy, Evan and I made this assumption that dry erase cards were just going to be way too expensive, and we'd have to, you know, we'd have to charge $150, like my father's work for a pun making party game, which is just not tenable, right? But a piece of advice I give to new creators who ask us for advice when they start getting down the manufacturing path is to talk to your manufacturing partner early and often. Because we went down all sorts of silly roads with Puns of Anarchy. We were using Scrabble tiles. We were using stickers. We were using all sorts of dumb stuff that was cumbersome and time consuming and wasteful and not fun. And one day I said to Evan, well, let me just email our account rep at the manufacturer and see what she thinks. And she emailed back kind of quickly. It was like, yeah, dry erase cards. We just got to coat them with this thing and it's going to be 3 cents to add it to the whole print run. And like we burnt so much time in development worrying about this thing instead of just asking the people who knew the answer. And, you know, luckily the game came out great. It's a lot of fun. It's really, really funny. And the components work well to serve the fun core activity. But we really did go down some really silly paths and waste a lot of time before we got there.
Yeah. Tell me about your playtesting regime or regiment however you would say it. Tell me about how you playtest. Who do you bring together? What sort of mix of people are you looking for to playtest? And we hear it very, very often how important playtesting is. But tell us, you know, any nuances, any tips on getting people to playtest your game and then giving you honest answers. I think you don't want your friends to playtest your game because they'll never answer honestly. If they really don't like something about your game, they have a hard time saying that because of the relationship there. What's your experience with playtesting? How best to playtest?
Yeah, I think, and sorry to step on your toes here, Evan, if you want to go first, but yeah, I think there's a spectrum for us. I think for me, I am fortunate that my wife can often be my toughest critic. I think Evan will remember one of the early builds of Puns of Anarchy. She was one of our first playtesters, and we met at like a smoothie bar or something. And played a really early build with her. And after about 10 minutes, she was like, this is dumb. and I think maybe that version of the game was dumb. But, you know, being able to kind of talk to her about what she thought was dumb and what didn't work is very informative. But I think it is important to really play with, you know, friends, people who don't, you know, put 30 hours a week into playing something like Gloomhaven, who might just want to sit down for 10 or 15 minutes and get a few laughs while they're having beers with their friends. But then it's also important to get feedback from the diametric opposite end of the spectrum, where like we've got a board game bar in Memphis called Board to Beers, and we're really friendly with ownership there. And this past weekend, I took our very early stage new concept there to play with people whose like social life revolves entirely around playing games, right? And the way people who play games with that level of passion and commitment are able to articulate what works well and what doesn't work well and why they like certain things and why mechanics work is just so efficient and actionable because they've played everything under the sun and they spend a lot of time playing. But the downside is you can go down the path with that group of people and create something that is so wildly complicated and difficult and hard to understand that somebody like my wife won't even open the box because you can just tell from the package that it's going to be too much. So it is important to get, you know, both ends of the spectrum and some smattering of in between so you can create something that's fun and that works well, but that's also accessible and easy to understand and intuitive in a sort of party casual atmosphere.
I think I'll jump in there and just say, yeah, I agree with all of that. And then maybe to talk about it just from the very practical sense of playtesting, which I think doesn't get talked about a lot, is that, you know, playtesters are a very finite resource because you've got your, you know, if you're lucky, your 10 people in your life who you can get to sit down and play a game with you. Hopefully you can get those people to play a game more than once. And that's really valuable. right. A lot of times you won't though. And also once somebody plays a game, even if it's an earlier version, like they are now changed as a play tester because really you, especially as you get closer and closer to your final game, like you need to be seeing it with people who've never even heard of it before. Because you need to see, well, how does a first time player get this game? I think a lot of sometimes people forget that essentially everyone playing their game is going to be a first time player. That's the majority of people who play your game. And so that can be a difficult thing, finding new people. One strategy that's worked for us is, you know, even if they're acquaintances who might want to try a game, one thing that will really entice people is we'll go to a brewery, we'll open up a tab and say, hey, basically, as long as you want to sit here and play these games, we're going to keep buying you beer and snacks. And so that always helps. But, you know, it is tough logistically just to, like, we couldn't do a play test every day, even though we might want to, both with our own schedules, other people's schedules, like, and so because of that, you know, it's probably important for new or seasoned creators to show up to their playtests kind of with a agenda, with a bit of a plan, and try and get as much out of it as you can because, you know, it might be 3 weeks before you really get another serious playtest down.
Well, so much good information, guys. Very, very helpful. As we close up, let's talk to new creators, new game designers. What are the outstanding tips that just come to the top of mind that you want to share with them? What are some of the best trade shows that they need to be involved in? Give us some of your best tips for new game creators.
I'll start here. Can I laugh heartily that we are the exact wrong people to ask about trade shows?
yeah.
we've talked every year about how next year is going to be the year where we take trade shows seriously. We still haven't been to one. I think we're going to,
that answer is completely valid. And it's a little bit refreshing, on the show. Yeah. I mean, tell us your perspective. Are trade shows valuable and maybe not for you in this particular business model? Tell us about it.
Yeah. So I, the more Evan and I talk to other successful game makers, the more I recognize that our business model, is an outlier. We are a very direct to consumer e-commerce first, just because that's how we grew up with Charty Party and Kickstarter. And we're just now starting to get into retail with Ransom Notes, you know, 4 or 5 years into the business. So early on, we didn't see a ton of value in trade shows because, we weren't focused on retail. We were focused on, can we find somebody on the internet who wants to click on one of our advertisements, buy a box of our game on Amazon or off of our website, and we'll ship it to them? And that worked really well for us. So it just wasn't a high priority. But I told somebody at the play test at the board game bar I referenced, this is somebody I've met, you know, a few times over the years, and he's always told me about this concept he's been working on for 3 years. And I was just like, man, it's way easier to get an idea from where it is today onto Kickstarter. It's way easier than you think, and you just need to do it because you might find an audience. We started off talking about Kickstarter. I think the it's very forgiving to board games because that stuff I told you about my father's work, like the game creators know that, but the audience knows that too. And people who are devoted to playing games as part of their social life know that they're going to be able to find stuff on Kickstarter that they're never going to see in Barnes and Noble. They're never going to see on Amazon. And it might be their one shot to get something that they find, you know, really, really magical and engaging. And I think, you know, just have the courage to get your idea into a prototype that you could put out in front of the world and see if you can make something happen. Like I said, we never expected Charity Party to be what it became. But now this is our full-time job, and I don't think either one of us would look back. So
Just do it.
And Phil, there's so many things I could say there, but I think I'm putting myself in my own shoes 5 years back, and I would be very interested in what I'm hearing from me and Josh right now, but also being like, but how the heck do you sell your games? And how do you get people to find you if you're not going to trade shows and you're not doing things like that? And the answer in our case, when Josh talks about the unusual business model, or rather the different business model that we rely on or have done to this point, we are really Facebook and Instagram ad heavy. That is the main thing that drives our sales. And, you know, once you have success with that, then you're up in the rankings on Amazon. And, you know, there's some kind of other avenues that people start to find you by. But by and large, doing heavy digital advertising is the way that we've grown our business and is still really kind of the bread and butter of what we do today. So it's absolutely not the only way to do it. But I know that when you see a lot of those big million-dollar plus Kickstarters, they're pretty much getting to those numbers in two ways. It's either they had a really large following before and they're able to just hit that email button and or, you know, post on their social media and they have that following. But for the rest of us, it's usually that they're spending a decent amount of money on Facebook and Instagram and potentially other platforms advertising to drive traffic there. So that's how it works for us.
Just great information, guys. I know that my audience is going to have more questions for you. How can they reach out, connect with you, ask questions, just get to know you guys and buy games? How can they connect?
Probably the best way is to head over to our website at veryspecialgames.com. There's a contact us form on there, and we are pretty good about getting back to folks. We'll do our best. And that's the best way to check out our games and pick yourself up a copy as well if you're interested.
That is awesome. An efficient, streamlined two-man company. Well done, guys. Thanks for coming on the show, sharing some very, very valuable information. And best of luck to you and good luck on Kickstarter for your next game.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. Take care.
Thanks, guys. We'll talk soon. Bye. Thank you for tuning in to the Power Kid podcast. Don't forget to subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. Leave 5 stars and a written review as this helps us connect with more listeners just like you. Once you're subscribed, you'll be able to check out the other shows from Adventure Media and Events. And a big thank you to them. They are the publishers of the Toy Book, the Toy Insider, and the Pop Insider. We've got you covered on all toy industry news and events. This show is produced by Power Kid Design and Development. We are a full-service toy and game development studio serving the industry for more than 20 years. We provide illustration, branding, packaging, sculpting, prototyping, consulting, and much more. Check out powerkiddesign.com or email me at phil@powerkiddesign.com. Now go out and make something great, and remember, you are creative because you were created. God bless, and I'll see you next episode.